Hi, and welcome to Five Compelling Questions with Sean, the podcast where we talk to writers. It's conversations with writers, and that's what we do here. Through a series of questions, always more than five, but that's the name of the show, so that's what we call it. We call it Five Compelling Questions with Sean, even though it's like 25 questions each time. I have another returning guest. People are coming back, so that's a good sign. My returning guest today is Tina Zabelagarde. Hi, Tina.
Hi, Sean. Thank you for having me again.
Yeah, you're back. So it wasn't that terrible the first time, huh?
No, I loved it. You're natural at this. You're just so good at making us all feel comfortable and able to talk about what we do.
Oh, well, that's sweet of you to say. Yeah, I told one of my other authors on a recent episode, I'm going to start charging what psychiatrists charge per hour to talk to you guys.
Good idea. It does help us things out.
Yeah, well, you know, being an author, as people who aren't writers, it just comes with there's just a level of anxiety that comes with anything where you're putting yourself out there in any kind of performance kind of way or art. You know, it can be terrifying to have people read your work and go, "Ooh, do I love this?" Or
that's what took me so long to get into a profession that was always my dream, was getting up the nerve to share my writing, to find out if I could even do it, if I was even qualified to do it. So yeah, at one point, you know, you just say, I'm a grown girl now. I can have someone look at my writing, but you're right. It makes you very vulnerable.
It does. And there's no, like, you know, tests or processes to go through for people to say, okay, now you're good enough to be a writer. Go publish books. So there's no, it's sort of like, I think I'm good. Let's see if anyone else does.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And I'm not so sure I even thought I was good, you know, and that was like the hump to get over. I'm not even sure I think I'm good yet, you know, and I need somebody else to validate that, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think you're great. I think you're a wonderful writer, and obviously a lot of other people do too, because you've been nominated for a couple of awards, right?
Yeah, so that's been very exciting. Yeah, Winter Witness was nominated for an Agatha Award for Best First Novel, a Silver Falchion, and Mystery Mayhem. Actually, I'm a finalist. I don't think that hasn't been given yet, so that's still pending. But it's been that Winter Witness went off really well, and so I'm very excited because Dead Man's Leap is right around the corner.
I know, and this is the I say Batavia on Hudson. Is it Batavia or Batavia?
That's what I say too. But some people say Batavia. I say Batavia.
Potato. Exactly. Whatever way you want to say it, it's a great series. So, and it's set in the, well, you say, what is, tell us about the books. Tell us about the series. Tell us the actual name of it and tell us the books and tell us what is the series about. And your name's about.
So it's the Batavia on Hudson mystery series. I have two books in the series so far. Winter Witness was the first. That was the one that was nominated. And it came out in September 2021. I don't even know. How is that possible? This is the book that introduces you to my protagonist. It's Bianca St. Denis. She moves to this new small town with her husband. They retire from teaching so he can be a hobby farm and work his hobby farm, and she can do her writing finally full time. And she kind of stumbles into the middle of a murder investigation because she befriends the local historian who tells her all kinds of things about the village, and she realizes she might have some insight and kind of starts, you know, she's an amateur sleuth. She doesn't know it, but that's what she is. She's a historian, so she's very observant, and she's an outsider, so she's got fresh eyes on the situation, and she kind of stumbles her way through and kind of annoys the sheriff, but they have a very interesting dynamic. And the second book is called Dead Man's Leap. That's due out in a few days, and we pick up with the same cast of characters, and this time there's a storm, and the village ends up, it's already an intimate village. Now they end up in an evacuation center because of the storm. And now they're in even closer quarters. So there's some simmering, you know, feuds or irritations that come to the surface, and the storm washes up a corpse, and they have to investigate, of course. And somehow, because the community is all there in one place, she manages to, once again, Bianca manages to get herself kind of embroiled in this investigation again. And the third book is I'm working on now, and working title is Autumn Dispatches. And as a result of things that happen in book two, Dead Man's Leap, Bianca will be going to Japan in the third book. So part of it will be set in Japan. So I'm very excited working on that one. And that's it. And then of course there are themes to the book, which, you know, we'll get to, I guess, but that's my series. I've got the three under, you know, working furiously on book number three right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a great series. And obviously other people think you're good enough, like I said, because you've been getting a lot of accolades and good reviews and award nominations, and you can't do any better than that with a debut sort of series. So
yeah, I was sort of floored by all of that. So
yeah. Yeah. So now you can just go forward boldly and not worry about it. Although we all worry about it every single time, because it's kind of like, is this a good story? I don't know. I think it's good. And then it's like, oh, it's terrible.
Do it a second time. Then the second book is a little bit different from how I approached the first book. So does this style work? It's not that my style is different, but I guess the approach. And the third book is going to be in Japan. So I'm like, oh no, now I'm keep challenging myself. I just can't sit back on my laurels, I guess, you know.
Well, that's smart, because you don't want to repeat yourself. Even, sure. You know, you have, yeah. Sure. Well, let me do, for people who don't know who you are, but I think a lot of people probably do if they listen to the show, but we'll just do an introduction for someone that might be listening in reverse order of the episodes, which I do sometimes with shows. Tina de Bellegarde's debut novel, Winter Witness, is the first on the Batavia on Hudson Mystery Series, which we were just discussing. It was nominated for an Agatha Award for Best First Novel, Silver Falchion, and a Chanticleer Mystery and for Murder and Mayhem Award. My tongue is tied today, and I have a puppy on my lap that doesn't want to settle down. Reviewers have called Tina the Louise Penny of the Catskills, and you cannot get higher praise than that in our community.
I love that.
That's amazing. This is also very cool, and I think you should just stop being self-doubtful right now. Her story, Tokyo Stranger, appears in the Mystery Writers of America anthology, When a Stranger Comes to Town. Mm. And that is very impressive. And that's edited by Michael Corita.
Yeah, I that was pretty exciting when I got that email.
Yeah, and that was a fierce competition to get into that anthology. They weren't handing out spots, and there were very limited spots, and you had to be up to snuff. Because who were some of the other people in that anthology with you?
Oh gosh, Michael Connelly and Joe Lansdale, Lisa Unger, Laurie Roy. My story is in between Stephen Hamilton and Joe Hill. Jonathan Stone, Michael Corita. So it was a really big deal.
It's a big deal.
I just love to see my name in there.
Yeah, when I heard that news, I actually yelled out loud at my dad. I was like, oh my God, Tina got in there, love this author. So that's a huge deal. That's huge. So yeah, I think you're good. You don't need to worry anymore. Michael Corita he's from Bloomington, same as me. That's my only connection to him. But I do like his books. We're both from, it's not a big place and there's not a lot of people from there. So, you know, and it's where IU is. So yeah. And then your short fiction also appears in the Best New England Crime Stories. You're the vice president of the Upper Hudson chapter of Sisters in Crime. You're a member of Mystery Writers of America and Writers in Kyoto. And you live in Catskill, New York with your husband, Dennis, and your cat, Shelby, where you tend to beehives, harvest shiitake mushrooms, cultivate vegetable garden. That sounds idyllic. And you traveled to Japan regularly to visit your son, Alessandro. So there is a Japanese connection. So it's not just you just decided to randomly write about Japan. You have a connection there.
I do have a connection there. And Bianca also has a son in Japan, because it just made it logical so I could write in Japan into my series somehow, because it's just a beautiful place. And I'm really missing it, because the last time I was there was 2017. I tried to go every couple of years. And on 2019, I said I needed to postpone it a year. I had a few things going on. And that was a mistake, of course, because here we are, 2020, 2021, 2022. The doors are still closed. They won't let me in.
Yeah. It's been very tough with international travel. I mean, I haven't seen any of my international friends. And I mean, I can't imagine being that far away from your son and not being able, that's so sad.
He did come home last fall, but I can't get back there yet. So
yeah. Yeah, and you were saying you don't know what year it is because we've all been in this weird time warp. You know, we're all in this strange new existence. Don't know where what time it is or whoever where anyone is. Yeah. So, well, let's get to the interview after, you know, the gigantic preamble, to which is always the way it goes with me. I just can't stop talking. First question. How has writing a novel and getting it published taught you anything? Has writing a novel and getting it published taught you anything about yourself?
You know, it really has. You know, you think you get to a certain age, you know yourself so well, but it's really amazing how much you keep amazing yourself, right? I think about quite a few years back now, my husband and I took the Camino de Santiago, the trip across Spain for the pilgrimage, over 500 miles on bike. And that trip was really remarkable for us. It's not like I'm a biker or an athlete, you know, up mountains, down mountains, treacherous roads, all kinds of crazy things, 500 miles in a couple of weeks. And I know people do more, but it wasn't exactly bicycle friendly. Anyway, the reason I mention it is because when I finished it, I couldn't even believe I did this, that I accomplished this. You know, sometimes it was 110 degrees out. It was just like this thing that I never thought of doing and I never thought I could accomplish. And look, now I have. So that whole limitation that I put on myself was all in my head and it's gone. You know, I can do that kind of thing. And when I got into writing and publishing, getting my book published, I kind of encountered a similar thing. I realized that the limitations were limitations I put on myself. When I took myself seriously enough to go to a conference and pretend I was one of those writers at the conference, you know, and started meeting people who are now my friends, but all these new authors to me that, you know, getting to actually meet them and ask their advice and whatever, they so supportive, but they used to repeatedly say things like, when my book gets published, not if. They always said when. And that was so encouraging. And I asked a few of them why they were so confident about, I said, you really don't know me or my writing. And this is what they told me. More than one person, several people told me this, that I had the courage to do this, to take my dream and make it a reality. So many people talk about, I want to write a book someday, but they never sit down to do it. So I sat down and I started a book. And they said, you know, when people start a book, they don't usually finish a book. And so you did both. You started, you finished. Now you're here networking, trying to find yourself a publisher. You're going to get critiqued. You're going to revise your manuscript. You're going to get this published. You're going to do what needs to be done. Because after a certain point, it's a task to do. And it's that encouragement and that frame of mind that really taught me that, yeah, this is just a limitation that I put on myself, that whether I can write, whether we were just talking about whether I'm good enough, whether, you know, and it taught me to dream bigger, to look, to see things bigger. I don't know what the next one will be, what the next challenge will be, but I know that I feel like I could do it, which maybe, you know, 20 years ago, maybe I wouldn't, you know, different kind of person on the other side of it. I'm a different kind of person.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a huge transition from wanting to achieve something to having achieved it. And you do go through a personal transformation. And I've seen it. I've watched you do it. And it's impressive. I've seen you from all the stages.
It's true. You've been there from the very beginning. I remember actually meeting you the day, not meeting. I had met you before, but meeting you under the circumstances of having my contract, getting, you know, being offered my contract. And I was so nervous to meet you, the three of you, because this time I wasn't just meeting other writers and agents and editors that could help me and maybe give me advice. I wanted to make such a good impression. And I was such a nervous wreck, not knowing when I saw you there that, you know, we'd have this long relationship, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, here we are. And it's going pretty well.
I think so.
I mean, well, if someone said, hey, do you want to drive 500 miles somewhere? I'm like, probably not. You know, pretty sure I wouldn't be wanting to bike it either. I mean, I can't believe you did that. That's pretty impressive. But I get that's a really good analogy because, you know, when I was working on movie sets, a short day is 12 hours standing on your feet cooking. And, you know, a lot of times it's 16 hours or 18 hours. Yeah. And you know, at first people are like, that's impossible. And we're like, everything seems impossible until you actually doing it. And you're like, this is just, you get used to it. It's really hard in the beginning to do things, but then you sort of, okay, this is a normal thing that we do and people do this and we can do this. And it's just getting yourself over the believing that you can do it hump. And then into the, okay, I've done that. And I might change the way I do this, but at least I know I can do it. You know,
it's that belief in yourself and you have to kind of prove it to yourself, not just to other people, but to yourself. And I don't know. Like I said, I don't know what the next challenge will be, but I welcome it.
Oh, there'll be one. Trust me. There'll be one.
There will be, I know.
Whatever it shall be, whatever will come to pass. I have full confidence you'll handle whatever it is that comes your way. You. Well, maybe it's this. Next question. What is the most difficult part of the creative writing process for you? And what is the easiest?
Yeah, you know, there are a few things that question makes me think of. Like, ideas are really easy for me. I have this huge file. I have a physical file and a computer folder full of short story ideas, flash fiction ideas, stories for the series, standalone. So conjuring up these ideas are really easy for me. And the other thing I was surprised to find out that is actually doable, easier for me than I thought, is that I write well under constraints of time or like story prompts or word count constraints, which I didn't think I would do well at, because I'm an over planner. I want plenty of time to do everything so that I don't ever find myself at a deadline, that I don't have to deal with stress. That's how I handle everything. The fact that I could write under time constraints and other constraints surprised me, but I think it helps me get rid of my hesitancy. And I just say, this is good. This is good. I actually can go with that. You know, I don't have to revise it 20 times. And so I'm finding those things easy. As far as difficult, I think the most difficult things for me, the things that are the most time consuming and require the most work, is my preparatory work. So for my series, for my books, what I've been doing is I flesh out my stories longhand. So like I have my concept, and then I brainstorm on a legal pad the whole story as if I'm telling somebody. I don't write the book, but I, you know, just write it out longhand. And then I reread it and fill in all the holes and see where the continuity issues are and if it's going to hold up. And I rewrite it until I think all of that stuff is. So I can do a longhand copy several times until I'm happy with it. Then I outline, then I flesh out my outline, and then everything goes into post-it notes scene by scene. So it's all on my whiteboard, every scene. That's so time consuming and it's a lot of work. But then when it's done, all I do is take off the post-it note and write. And then I get to do like the creative stuff and the writing stuff. And it's just like, I can just sit back and enjoy the writing. And I don't have to worry about, you know, getting halfway through the book and saying, no, this doesn't hold together. Like, you know, and so that part, it becomes, you know, all the hard work is up front, is front loaded. And then I can enjoy the writing.
That's good. That's a good method. That's a very good way to go. So you're like, not necessarily outlining, but you're laying out you're outlining in a way, because you're laying out your roadmap, but you're not so overthinking it so much that you're stuck. You're just sort of giving yourself a free formed, this is the way we're going to go today, kind of. That sounds very luxurious.
It is. It's luxurious. You use that word a lot. And the reason I mentioned it is because last time we spoke about short stories and novels and how you can luxuriate. You use that word exactly in a novel, and how we can't do that in a short story.
Yes. I love it when I'm quoted back to myself, when people actually listen to what I'm saying, because no one in my household is doing that. So my work colleagues at least pay attention to the things I say. But yes, well, I'm all about luxury, as we know. I'm a very VIP luxury kind of gal, down to earth, but I do like nice things. But yes, luxuriating is a lovely way to think about going about your work.
When you're writing and reading, and I love the word and I never use it. That's why it stuck with me when you used it. Now you used it twice on the podcast. And when I can read and write like that, right, luxuriate in it, that's wonderful. And
oh, yeah.
That's what I want my readers to do when they read my stuff. And that's what I want to do when I write. That's what I want to do when I read someone else's stuff.
Yeah.
It's a great word.
Like being in a bubble bath with a glass of wine. Can't get any better than that.
No.
Do
definitely.
It. Definitely. Might as well enjoy it. You got to do it anyway. You might as well enjoy the process. You know, that's right. My motto is enjoy the process.
What's that?
My motto is always enjoy the process.
That's right. Because it's all process.
Yeah. You don't enjoy it, then, you know, you need to change something.
Why are we doing it? Exactly. Anything.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. Next question. Who are your favorite authors to read before you just, who were your, huh, why can't I talk today? I have a podcast. Who were your favorite authors to read before you decided to pursue your own writing?
Well, I was always drawn to female authors. And as I was growing up as a young woman, as an early teenager, even, I was reading Anne Tyler, Gail Godwin, Marilyn French, remember her, Muriel Sparks, Miller. I absolutely love these women. And they really influenced my view of the world. And I kind of grew up reading them. So it gave me fodder, you know, stuff to think about who I wanted to be as a woman. And they wrote women's stories and they made me believe that a woman's story is worth telling, you know, and they kind of focused on the interior world of these women, these female characters, and they did it with beautiful prose. So I love to read them for lots, multiple reasons. And, you know, for me, that's important because I'm a character writer. Like my novels are very character driven. People say they're kind of a cross between traditional mysteries and women's fiction because I kind of go off on my tangents. And so these writers were all masters of character development. And so I really admire how they do that. And the other writers, like in the mystery genre, for example, you know, there's always Agatha Christie, but it was Martha Grimes who really made me love this kind of genre that's more like my book, that Agatha Christie's different than my writing, obviously, for so many reasons. Of course, I'm not trying to compare myself to Agatha Christie. I just mean that Martha Grimes introduced me to the idea of writing about a village, but also about not just the puzzle, but the people in the puzzle. And that clicked with me immediately. And so that was where my head was when I was thinking about writing a traditional mystery. It had to be more about that, about the people underlying and the motivating forces and what else is going on in their lives besides this puzzle. And then I recently got into flash fiction and that I kind of just stumbled on that. And I was reading On Earth We Are Briefly Gorgeous. Have you read this book, Ocean Vuong? Oh my gosh, mm-hmm. This book, I had to read it twice. As soon as I finished it, I had to start again. So poetic, so beautiful. Of course, he's a poet, but this is a novel. And I hadn't read his poetry before I read the novel, but it's full of these little nuggets of beauty. And even though then you add them up and they make a novel, right? But reading him made me write flash fiction because you could, you know, kind of just extract these little pieces that stood alone so beautifully. And that changed my writing quite a lot, just reading his book and then getting into flash fiction.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you have to read, and you have to read sort of outside of your genre too. You have to read everything because it just bolsters your, you know, your talent or, you know, your motivation. It gives you fuel, you know, for your
creativity. Exactly. It's fuel. I recently read, I think Katrina McPherson, I think it was in her masterclass at Murderous March, someone said something about how she gets everything done. You know, she does too much. It might've been that or on a Facebook post. And she said that she reads for 4 hours a day, approximately, because it's part of her work. Mm-hmm. It is, whether it's writing reviews or blurbs, but it's also about consuming it, right? And I remember you asked in your podcast last year about when we first appreciated the power of words, right? And flash fiction was that time for me. And reading that, it's so far from my genre, but it influences my writing, in my mystery writing. You know, you wouldn't think it would, but it does. You know?
Yeah, for sure. 4 hours, because she does get a lot of reading done. I like seeing her Friday Reads posts on Facebook. I was like, it's always so interesting. And many times I just go in and I put that book in my, you know, my Goodreads TBR, because I'm like, oh, that sounds like something I would like. So I definitely look forward to her her commentary on what she's been reading. So
yeah, I agree. And she's also very good about making sure she takes some time to read new authors and gives us a little press, because, you know, everybody knows about the latest, greatest book that's coming out. We'll hear about it somewhere else if we don't hear it from her, but she makes a point of helping the newbies get heard about, you know.
Yeah. She's one of the most wonderful people in our community. She's just a joy. She's just a joyful person to know, and she's a wonderful person. So we got a lot of them, but she's one of them. She's on that list.
I agree.
Yeah. So next question for you, and I will try not to flub it this time. Why can't I talk? What do you hope readers will take away from reading your book, this latest book?
Okay. Well, you know, just even for both books, but even for this latest book, I write a book about a village inhabited with all these characters that I want people to be able to want to come back to. I want them to feel welcome and want to immerse themselves in there. And so I really want it to be an escape, but I also want people to feel and to think and to relate and to empathize. I really want them to get to know my characters and think, you know. And I think that we read for lots of reasons, but one of the reasons is because we can relate to what's happening to characters, their emotions and everything. So to me, that character-driven aspect of my book is the most important. And I want people to think, you know, Winter Witness was about personas, how you, what you put out to the public and how the public will accept it or reject it, or maybe accept it a little too willingly, you know, kind of look the other way. And Dead Man's Leap is about the burden of secrets. It's about thinking you can outpace your past and how dangerous that is, about the relief of renunciation, just giving in sometimes and cutting losses or just moving on or taking a leap of faith. And those are the kinds of things that I hope when someone closes my book, that they're still thinking about, not just the puzzle, not just the plot, but about those people and about those themes. I want a book that makes people think and feel, you know, that's what I want to read. So that's what I want to give my readers.
Yeah, it comes across. Your character stays with me because I don't read them. You know, I read them a couple times when they're in production because I read all of your all's books a couple times, but then, you know, you move on to the next book and I'm working all the time and reading all the time. And I'm trying to read for myself and write for myself. But your character stays with me throughout the downtime, I guess is what I would call it, when I'm not working actively on reading your stuff, but she stays with me. So you've done that job because that's what you want to do.
Very happy to hear that. Thank you.
Well, obviously your books resonate with a lot of people. So that's, I think your self-education in the women's fiction that you mentioned early on in the interviews is important because that's what those books, I feel we're trying to do back in the ones that you mentioned early on. So, cause I read all those too. I worked at a bookstore, so I read everything on my lunch. You're in the break room, like reading the newest book that just came out. Cause you can, it's right there. You just grab
it. Right. I worked in the library and it's just a pleasure to be. I get to work here. This is too good to be true.
Surrounded by books all the time. I worked at every major chain there was. Yeah,
that's right.
All right. So fifth question, something different. We like to say, if you couldn't write, what would you do instead?
Okay, so I think if I had the talent and I could break in, I'd love to be a filmmaker. And my son is a filmmaker and it's part of what he does. So I'm kind of already, I guess, prone to thinking that way. But I think in images when I write. So for me, when I create a scene, I try to imagine how it might be shot, as a photograph, as a still, or in a film. And so for me, they're sort of related. It's telling stories just with a different medium. And I would love to make films. I don't think it's an obvious route for me, but if I didn't turn into a writer, I think I would have tried to pursue that field. And you know, it's not so much because I think that my books will be made into films or TV or anything, it's because if I can imagine it, if I can see it, then I'm hoping I can relate that to my reader so they can see it. And if you can see it, it stays with you, you know?
Yeah, absolutely, for sure. Yeah, I always wanted to go to film school myself. The film is one of the things I wanted to pursue.
But you know, we've learned that you and I are actually so much more alike than we realized and have so many similar experiences that we realized. It's really not surprising to me that you should say that.
I know. Well, for those who don't remember from the other episode, we went to the same little tiny school in Florida. Like that was so bizarre. It was like, oh yeah, I just randomly mentioned it. I'm like, oh my God, we're to school there too.
So bizarre about it is I only lived here for 1 year. It's not like I lived here. I didn't grow up here. I was only here for a year and I happened to go to the same school, different times. We were not in class together, which would have been, could you imagine? That would have been
crazy. Yeah. That would have been crazy. I'm still in touch with them, classmates from there. It's so funny because it's a tiny little school, like a little church school. And we both went there.
Yeah.
St. Anthony. But yeah, we do have a lot of connections. We're very similar.
We are.
I'm a little more laid back than you, but I can see you got the Florida vibe going on. You're definitely more chill this year.
Yeah, I'm definitely working on it. And I feel you've rubbed off on me and I'm very grateful. I can't tell you how grateful. Sometimes I quote you, you know, it's like, well, like Sean says, it'll all be fine. And it is, because it almost always is, right? So, you know, I mean, not everything in our life goes exactly, but most of the time, as long as you're putting in the work and some of the planning, then it'll work out.
Yeah, that's just sort of, you know, because I grew up in a chaotic childhood with a lot of things happening that I could not control. And, you know, it wasn't easy a lot of the time. And then, you know, I had to put myself through college. There was a lot of things in early on in my life that were like, oh, okay, well, this isn't ideal, but basically kind of figured out really early that these are the thing I can control is my reaction to other things.
That's right.
I can control the way I'm going to, because, you know, if you start freaking out and then nothing gets done, you're just making it worse, basically.
In your wheels. Yeah, that's right.
So I just learned that really early. My sister and I both learned that really early. It's like, okay, you have 300 people coming in on a movie set for dinner. We don't have anything ready. We could start screaming. And, you know, but what are we going to do? Let's fix it. So let's do the best we can to fix it. You know, let's just fix this. But most of that is coming from within you. So you can, okay, how am I going to manage this? Basically, people are people. They're going to understand if something went wrong. We'll figure it out. We'll make it better. We'll make it up to them kind of thing. You know, just do it. You just get through it. You do it. But maintaining your inner self is the first step. And then everything else will fall into place is what I always, that's what I tell. I mean, of course, I have my moments too where I'm like, I don't curse on the show, but I've cursed at my desk by myself with some stuff happening.
We all do, don't we? But we've also learned as we get older, as we experience life, that we have to keep things in perspective. You know, really, really do have to keep things in perspective. Yeah. And it's true what they say, you know, it doesn't, you just get stronger. And
what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Nietzsche. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you for helping me retrieve my mic. It was there. It just wouldn't come out.
They taught us that at St. Anthony's. No, I'm just kidding. They didn't teach Nietzsche at St. Anthony's. They were teaching Bible stuff.
That's right. But I am sure. I'm sure.
Yeah. That was college. All right. Final quiz. Rapid fire. We switched it up for season two. See if you get it wrong this time. I don't think so. I think you're fine. Okay. Summer or winter?
Wow, we can't do summer or winter. Summer, I guess. It's a tough one because winter's cozy, but summer has more possibilities. And that's, I guess, explains why I winter in Florida now. So, you know, it's an evolving thing. Not an easy rapid fire answer, I'm sorry.
No, it's not. And I'm not getting any straightforward answers from anyone because same thing. Most people like summer, obviously. Because it's nice out, it's easier, you know, you don't freeze to death if you get locked outside.
Yeah, getting older, so winter is less inviting than mm-hmm. it was. In other words, I still like the cozy aspect of the fireplace in the book and the stews and the breaking bread, but you do have to step outside. And once you do, you know, you fall, you slip, your back hurts when you shovel snow, and it just goes on and on and on. And I'm like, oh, I don't know. So here we are in Florida.
Yeah, but your book title is Winter Witness, so I thought you'd have a hard time with that one.
I have too.
Okay, sweet or savory? See if you do better on this one. Sweet or savory?
Savory. That's an easy one, definitely. I can walk past a table of sweets, but not fries or pretzels or, you know, a good steak or burger or something. You know, it's terrible. No resistance.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I can forego sweets for a sugar for a year. I could be no problem.
Yep.
But I need some potato chips. I need those potato chips. I can't. And it's like, is this all the chips you have? Cause I just ate them all. Sorry. Yeah, I'm terrible with that. I have a bad potato habit. Comedy or drama?
Drama. I like comedy. Obviously everybody likes to laugh, but drama fills me up, gives me something to think about, empathize. write, you know, it inspires my writing. You know, yeah. I love a good story. We just went through all the Oscar nominees, made a point of watching them all before the Oscars. And oh my gosh, they were so good this year. They were just so good. And they were, you know, some of them have some, you know, some comedic relief, but there are dramas mostly, and they were beautiful.
Yeah. Which one was your favorite one?
I have to say Belfast.
Okay.
But it was hard because The Power of the Dog was amazing. Coda was good, really good. What was the other one I loved? I loved Belfast. I really, really loved that. Drive My Car, I really enjoyed also. That's the Japanese import.
Yeah.
That was nominated for Best Picture, but it did win Best International Film. And yeah. Anyway, there were just so many good ones. Everyone I saw, I loved.
Yeah.
Did you?
Yeah. Well, I liked Coda a lot. Yeah. I do. Now we have another thing. Cause I do that every year. I make sure I watch all of them, before. And I've actually gone back, and I'm such a nerd. I have a spreadsheet going back to 1970 of best picture, best, the major ones, like best actor, best actress, best director. Yeah. Big, you know, again, that's pretty much covers all the movies usually that you need to see. Because I didn't go to film school because I really wanted to go to NYU film school. That was, you know, if I was going to be a writer, I wanted to be a screenwriter, which, you know, never, I can still do that, obviously. That's but right. So there's that, but I didn't get to go to film school. I was an English major and I became a writer, which is totally fine. That was actually my number one career choice anyway. And everything's been great. But I was like, well, I hate like when I'm in a conversation about movies and I don't know what someone's referring to. So I was just going to give myself a film education on my own. So I just would go like to the library. The library had most of the old ones, you know, just go check it out and watch, you know, A Woman Under the Influence or like whatever they were. And that was my project on the weekends when I lived in New York. I would just like go rent old weird movies at Blockbuster and watch them. And then I caught myself up. So I caught up. I'm all caught up from 1970. And I'm like, well, I have to keep it going. So every year I was like, I have to go see. So one year I'll never forget. It was the year Monster was nominated. With Charlize mm-hmm. Theron, mm-hmm. and I convinced my best friend to go with me, and it wasn't playing here in our town. We had to go down to like towards DC to watch it, and we got, and it was just, it's a very good movie, but it's a very traumatizing, triggering movie, a lot of sexual violence in it, and she was like, she just had this like look on her face. As we got back in the car, she's like, okay, I could close the book on never seeing that again ever in my entire life, and I won't be able to sleep for weeks. I'm like, I'm really sorry. So then I was like, I can't believe we drove all the way to D. And then the next week it was up here. We could have seen it like in our backyard, but I'll never forget that. I was like, you're such a good friend to come to see this movie.
But you know, that's really, if you go with the intention of watching all of the nominees for Best Picture, right? You go, you might watch movies you might not choose to watch otherwise. And you aren't disappointed usually because they're usually always so good. And we do it every year. We used to go to a marathon. Now during COVID we have it like go to theaters, AMC and Regal do them, right? All 10 films or 8 films. Wow. Over 2 days or over the weekend. And there are tons of movies we would not necessarily have first gone to see, and yeah. They are, you get rewarded for it, right? By sitting yeah. through it.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. Our little we have a local theater here. We live in a historic Civil War era kind of town, but it's a really old theater. And they show all the short films that are nominated every year. So you can go and watch all the short, which, you know, you might not be able to find those elsewhere.
Yeah, they're hard to find, and they're so good usually. Yeah. I have an indie theater by us up in New York that does that too.
It's pretty awesome.
You need to just call each other separately and do a film discussion.
Yeah, we'll have to live text each other next year when we're doing it and say, what did you think?
Good idea.
That would be fun. Yeah, but it's so cool.
I always watch it with my son. He streams through FaceTime. And I put the computer in front of the TV, and then I put my chair next to the computer, and we watch together every year.
Oh, sweet. That's cute.
It's our thing.
That's very cute. Yeah, I always watched with my mom too. So we had to discuss like what happened at the Oscars. And she's like, let's talk.
So next.
Talk about triggering. That was tough.
Yeah.
Oh, that was, I was traumatized. So. All right, we've gone off the rails on our quiz, but I think it was worth it because now we know we have even more stuff in common. Early bird or night owl?
Oh, early bird. I love my mornings. And as a result, there is often not much of a night because, you know, 5:30 is not uncommon. And so, you know, 9 o'clock is it. Sometimes 8:45, you know, just like dragging myself around trying to get to 9 because it's just the principle of it. you know,
because you're a grown up. Nobody, you're not 11 years old. You know, you don't go to bed at 8:30.
Exactly. I mean, sometimes it's 12 and 1 o'clock, which is a problem if I get up at 5:30, 6:30, you know,
yeah.
But I mean, a lot of adults get up early, but I'm definitely an early bird. It's a preference. I don't need to do that. And I prefer it always.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel fresher. My brain works definitely better in the morning. After about 4 or 5, I'm like, ugh, I just want to drink wine.
Exactly. That's where I'm. Yeah, exactly. I could be done by 4 or 5, you know, with brain activity. I mean, so I have to kind of take advantage of the early part of the day.
Yeah, for sure. People want to set a late meeting. I'm like, okay, well, won't be responsible for the things
can't
I
make
saw.
Any promises, right?
I'll show up, but you know, I probably won't follow through on anything I tell you. All right. So coffee or tea is my final question.
Oh, coffee.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I love tea, but I couldn't live without coffee. I can live without tea.
Yeah.
I rely on it. I think if we say you were a coffee person. You
yes, know. I am.
Right.
Yeah. I like coffee. I like tea as well, but not, I, like you said, I could go without it, but I'll have tea in the, like the winter time in the afternoon, if I want something warm, I'll drink an herbal tea, but yeah, but I took January off. I did not have any coffee in January. I did a cleanse.
Oh, I remember seeing that on Facebook and I'm thinking, wow, Sean, I'm even admiring you more than I used to, because I don't know if I could do it.
I did no alcohol, no caffeine, no dairy. I basically like vegetables and lean, like shrimp, like fish and chicken. That was it. I didn't eat red meat. But yeah, I like all that stuff, but I just wanted to see basically if I could do it. And I just wanted to kind of kickstart the year feeling really good. So I did for 30 days or 31 days, whatever January is. But I tell you what, on February 1st, I got up and I went right to the coffee machine. I was like, boom. I had it all geared up from the night before. I had deep cleaned it. Like, it was all ready to go. I wasn't like, oh, maybe I won't have coffee. I'm like, oh no. First toot sweet, you know, February 1st, 5 a.m.
If you do something for 21 times or 21 days that you've created a habit, right? But yeah. You can't break that coffee habit so easily.
No.
And it's more than a habit. It's a, you know, I really create. I make my coffee with my eyes closed. You know, I do a pour over every morning. I don't have a machine and I love the pour over process. I mean, the whole thing, it's part of my, I can't do without it.
Yeah. It's very romantic. I'll tell you what, the first 3 days I was, had headaches and I was sweating and, I was irritable and people were asking me stuff. I'm like, I broke that after 3 days. I'm like, wow, this is really good exercise. So I can see exactly how, what has hold of me. That was the main part of this, sort of like a Zen yoga thing. I just wanted to be free of things. And I was, and I did not enjoy it very much. But like around mid-month, you're sort of like, this is really long. The January is the longest month of my life. And then it came back and I'm fine. But I definitely am drinking less coffee and less wine and stuff now, but for other reasons. But yeah, for sure. But I do love my coffee. I still have it in the morning. I'm so excited. I was so excited to get back to it.
I have cut my coffee back because I realized it was, you know, I was using it as fuel and I can't do that. And I'm already a bad sleeper. So I've cut how many cups, the size of my cup. And now I make, it's been probably a year that it's always half calf unless I'm out. Yeah. And as long as you have good tasting coffee, half calf is fine.
Yeah. Yeah. We have that at the beach because who wants to be wide awake at the beach, you know,
yeah. You don't want to sort of doze. No need for that.
No, I just want to sit on the beach and read and kind of be not jacked up. You know, I just want to be relaxed at the beach.
Exactly.
But I do need it sometimes if I'm riding at the beach, but that's it. But yeah, well, this was it was great to see you again and have you back on the show. Thanks for coming back.
You mean that you felt that there was enough to have me back, that I had enough to say. Thank you.
Oh, of course. Yeah, I'll have you back every year with your new books. So the Japanese one sounds really exciting. So I'll look forward to reading that one down the road.
Yeah, me too. I hope they get me in there before I have to hand it in. That's I'm crossing my fingers that I can re-immerse myself. You know, it's all very fresh in some ways in my mind, but not as fresh as I'd like it, but
yeah,
get there eventually.
Yeah. Well, good luck with that. So, what's next up for you? I know you're going to one place that I won't be at, but you're going to go to.
I'm really excited about Malice. I'm going to BoucherCon. I'll be at Sleuth Fest. So I'll see you at Sleuth Fest and BoucherCon, right? And of course, Crime Bake in the fall again. I tour with Lita Sedaris, Carol Puglio, and Jen Collinsmore, and we do virtual tours. So we're kind of up and running doing that again as the Sleuths and Sidekicks. And I chair or co-chair the Murderous March conference that just finished in March. But, you know, here we are starting to plan again, and you know all about that. So back on the treadmill for that. So don't have a date for Murderous March yet, but it's in March, everyone. So be prepared, save one weekend. And that's about it. I'm working on book three. I've got ideas for four and five. Actually, I can't decide. I have these two ideas and I'm not sure which one I'm going to go with. And that's where I am. Very exciting. I haven't written as many short stories or flash fiction this year. I kind of would like to get back to more of that. Although I have one submitted for the next mystery most traditional.
Yeah.
So I sent one in for that. And that's about the extent of it this year. Got to keep writing those.
Well, good luck. Good luck.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Well, it's always lovely to see you and lovely to talk to you. I will always have you back because I want to hear more stories about you and Alessandro and figure out what else we have in common, really.
Yeah, we have more, even more than we think. So
yeah. Well, have have a great rest of the day. It's always lovely to see you.
You too. Take care.
Thanks. Bye.
Thanks for having me.
Of course.